Well, how's June Chang? I learned something new, that there is such a thing as edible economics, and that is the title of your book. Subtitled, How Beef Explains Free Trade, which is still a mystery to me. I guess, I mean, we have lots of questions. It's a book so packed with information that I don't even know how to begin covering it. But the first thing I wanted to ask was, whatever gave you the idea of tying food to economics, except that from your background, I mean, I gather that you are somebody who loves food a great
That's
deal,
right. Yeah,
and you
no,
are an economist.
that's right. Well, my view is that modern capitalist economy, unless everyone understands at least some economics, democracy is meaningless. That you had the people, voting for Boris Johnson in the UK because he was a lovable rascal. People voting for George W. Bush because he looked like someone who you could have a beer with. What kind of reason that is it? Like it or not, economics is at the heart of our society. And I thought that it was very important to spread the economic knowledge among the general public. So I have been on some kind of one-person crusade for mass economic literacy campaign. And I thought that the best way to take economics to people is to start with food, which everyone can relate to. So that's how it came about.
But you view food as a cultural expression, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that touches upon so many of our aspects of our society. It touches on production, international trade, the health and inequality, and so that once you begin to talk about food, it is very easy to kind of take the reader into economics without them quite realizing it.
But it's not a trivial thing to up and move all the way from Japan halfway around the world.
Now, Korea.
Korea,
Well,
yeah.
Japan's just up the road.
Yeah, that's next door, yeah.
So what
No,
whatever.
this, by the way, from Hajun, from a geography graduate from Cambridge
Oh
University.
yes,
Just up the road from Japan. Okay. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, what's the answer? Why did you choose, and how did you manage to pull it off?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when I was an undergraduate student in South Korea, we were taught this very technical, apolitical standard economics, which of course has its uses. But I had, the bigger questions. The country was at the time going through a most extraordinary economic and social transformation, and the kind of economics that I was taught in university really didn't have much to say about it because it was all about equilibrium and price formation in the market and so on. So I wanted to explore the bigger themes of structural change, at the social conflict, and Britain at the time, sadly, much less so these days, at the time offered a much broader range of economics. And yeah, I wanted to study economics more broadly. So despite the fact that at the time, very few Koreans actually went to Britain to study, I chose to do that.
And they said they were so surprised that Korean would apply that they decided to let you in anyway.
Yeah, actually, when I arrived in Cambridge, there were only two Korean students in the whole university,
Right.
and I arrived with the four others. So that and one one of them, but who was already there left. So, yeah, in my first year in Cambridge, there were only 5 Korean students.
What year was that?
Oh, it was 1986. Yeah, so that was a time when very few people, yeah, actually heard about Korea, you know, and you know that it was a time when it took me 24 hours to go from Korea to Britain. I mean, these days, well, I mean, because of Putin's war, now we have to fly a few more hours. But, you know, before that, we could fly to between Korea and Britain in 11 hours or so. But in those days, you know, this was the time of the Cold War. We couldn't fly over the Soviet Union, so we first had to fly to Alaska, Anchorage, yeah, 9 hours, and then 2 hours of fueling stop, and then the plane came down to the Europe, but not to London, but only to Paris. So I had to wait in Paris for 3 hours for my connecting flight, yeah, that was my first international flight ever. So, yeah, there we go. Those are the days.
No kidding. I was thinking you might have been familiar with some of my contemporaries. Not quite a contemporary was John Maynard Keynes, who invested King's College's endowment with such skill that he set them up for decades to come.
That's right. Yeah, he did. I mean, he's one of the few economists that who have ever made money in the stock market.
Yeah. Right.
Most of them lose money. I mean,
well, the story goes. I don't know if you heard the story or not. Mm-hmm. During the 1940 conflict, the World War II, Keynes was working for the government because everybody was able-bodied and intelligent.
That's right, he was,
to get and do that. And the British government, Treasury, came to him and said, we're desperately short of, I think it was the Portuguese currency. Portugal was not involved in the conflict. So Keynes said, well, wait till tomorrow. You'll have all the, whatever the currency is.
Peseta, yeah. It is called
peseta.
You
would like. So he flooded the market with the pesetas that he had, which caused the currency to collapse totally.
Yeah.
And they desperately came to him and said, "Can you help us out? We seem to be in trouble."
Yeah, sounds just like Keynes. You know that he understood the market psychology. He was a very daring person, and yeah, I mean, there we go. Unfortunately, other economists have taken a more mechanistic view of the market, and they didn't do as well in the financial market as Keynes did.
I think one of the tutors that my contemporaries used was called Joan Robinson.
Oh, yeah.
Her name is probably still good around the university, but the more remarkable one was Brian Pollitt.
Being
the son of the head of the UK Communist Party.
I see. And, I didn't know that. Yeah.
He graduated the same year I did, with a first in economics, which they don't which they don't give out to anybody unless he probably got one.
Hey, Hajun, back to this book. What exactly is edible economics?
Oh, yes. So the idea is, it is actually quite a weird idea. I name each chapter after a food ingredient. So there's a chapter on prawn, chapter on okra, chapter on garlic, chapter on
I never thought okra played such a big role in anything. That was interesting. We just had that for dinner last night.
Right. And yeah, I start off with some story about that food item. You know, it could be the biology of that food item or the history behind it, or my personal relationship with that food item, anything. And then I somehow morph it into an economic story. And the main economic story may or may not have anything to do with the initial story. So, you know, I have a chapter called Beef, which starts with football, the soccer. And then somehow it becomes a story about the free trade. And I have another chapter that starts with carrot. And it somehow ends up being a discussion of the patent system. So it's a kind of a playful book, you know. Basically, the idea is that I'm trying to bribe my readers with an interesting story about food so that they would pay a bit of attention to the economic story that follows. So in that sense, it's a bit like the ice cream that some of your mothers might have offered to entice you into eating your greens, except that, my bribery is far better because it comes first, you know. So you don't have to read economics if you don't like it. But, you know, the hope is that somehow, yeah, you find that my story is interesting enough that before you know it, you will be reading about economics.
Exactly. No? Yeah, I loved your opening about garlic. I mean, that's you're talking about my mother-in-law.
Hold on a second, love. I want to record something here before I forget.
Okay.
Over here, generally, over here being in the U.S., economics is termed the dismal profession.
That's right.
And the reason for that is the single-handedly effort of one Thomas Malthus.
That's right. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if, in the current world situation, people might eventually reach the conclusion that Malthus was right.
I think that you know the population growth is an issue, but in the long run, I think Malthus was too pessimistic. You know, the world population has grown. By several times in the last century or so, and we still are producing enough food to feed everyone in the world, except that, you know, that it is unequally distributed, so there are a lot of people who are literally starving, a lot of children who are stunted because of lack of nutrition and so on, but in terms of sheer amount, we are able to, in theory, feed everyone. So I think I'm one of the people who are more optimistic about the human technological ingenuity.
Well, what about Thies, Rabbit? He did that Hong Kong dinner, was it, where he served not one thing that was not chemically based. This is a chef researcher in Paris.
Right, I don't know that story.
Yeah.
I mean, does the name Hervé Thies mean anything to you?
Yes, that's what
That's it.
No,
yeah.
No, probably not.
No, of course. We have been able to do that only because we have, to a large extent, industrialized agriculture. You know, so that you use a lot of chemical, a lot of energy in the form of farm machinery, you know, the greenhouse, energy for greenhouse gases and so on. So, it has been quite costly, but, you know, on the other hand, we have developed all these technologies to feed a lot more people than we could, even compared to, 50 years ago. So,
But we used up all the guano in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So they depleted guano, and then they found a way to fix nitrogen in the air to replace that. But now it's becoming a serious issue because this requires a lot of energy and fossil fuel. So yes, I mean, I'm not saying these are non-problems,
I wanted to remind Anne what guano is.
Yeah, I know what it is.
You know what it is. Virtue.
Yes.
Virtue.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. The guano featured in my chapter called Anchovies, because the most famous guano deposit was off the coast of South America, deposited by seabirds feeding on the anchovies riding on the famous Humboldt Current coming up from Antarctica. So, yes, I mean, the guano was at one point in the 19th century the economic engine for Peru. Economic historians talk about the guano boom, guano period in Peru.
But it's interesting to reflect on the Humboldt brothers. They were actually brothers. I don't know whether they were twins or not. But the university named after them is on Unter von Linden in Berlin.
Berlin. Yeah.
And I understand from one of the snippets in your book that he received an award or special recognition because he climbed the highest mountain anybody had ever climbed sometime in his life.
That's right. Until that point, it was this volcano in Ecuador called Chimborazo. And he didn't reach the top, but he climbed up to 5,500 meters or something like that. So at that point in the early 19th century, he held the world record for the highest climb.
Now, geographers are in love with the Humboldt Current. Whether economists are, I'm not sure.
These days most economists are not very aware of geographical dimensions of the economy. But yes, I mean, it's the most important current, I dare say. I mean, it basically feeds the whole of the South American continent.
Let me be timely with the personality again, because those of us who know soccer were reminded of the excellence of the Ecuadorian soccer team, which is, according to your book, is the number one in the whole world.
Uruguay, not Ecuador. Yeah.
Oh, Uruguay. I'm sorry.
That's right. Uruguay. Has won two World Cups. The very first one in 1930, and another one in 1950. Of course, there are teams that have won more World Cups than Uruguay. You know, Brazil has won six, and Italy and Germany have won four. You know, Argentina three. But the thing is, Uruguay has only 3.5 million people against 220 million of Brazil. So if you calculate it on per capita basis, it's by far the best footballing nation in the world. And
They just made it number three, though, right?
Sorry?
Uruguay just made it number three.
No, not in this World Cup, yeah.
Didn't they win?
This year it was Argentina.
Oh, right. Oh,
yeah, no, and no, but actually it's easy mistake to make because the two teams have very similar uniforms. You know, they used to be in the same country. Uruguay's official name is the Oriental Republic of Uruguay, because it used to be the eastern part of Argentina. So yes, I mean
I'm doing poorly today, though. I can't even remember.
You know, in Korea, you say that even monkeys fall from trees once in a while. So.
I picked out a few of what you might call my favorite stories.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about Uruguay and beef extract just now.
Yep.
But you have a long story about the man who invented that.
Levy, yeah. Yeah, Levy was this eminent German chemist who is considered to be one of the fathers of organic chemistry. And he invented this beef extract, which initially was commercially not viable because the ingredient was too expensive. So, his original idea was that if we make the beef extract, even poor people could access the beef. But that was commercially not viable until this the young German engineer who worked in Uruguay came up with the idea of producing it in Uruguay, where beef at the time was essentially a byproduct of the leather industry because there was no refrigerated or shed, therefore you couldn't export the meat. Yeah, so they exported the cow leather, and the meat was essentially the byproduct. So this company was set up in Uruguay in this town of Frei Bentos, which had for some people, it was a famous brand name for corned beef. Yeah, which was crucial in feeding the populations of Britain and the Soviet Union during the Second World War. I mean, at one point, one-seventh of meat supplied to Britain was corned beef from, not entirely, but mostly Uruguay. So, yes, I mean, it played a huge role in that. Yeah.
Yeah, during World War II, it actually came in cans.
That's right, yeah.
I think people were still discovering cans of corned beef decades later.
That's right. I love corned beef.
Whether it was still any good, that wasn't the question. The question was, were you hungry? I did like your story about Elvis and his love of some kind of sandwich made at least partly from bananas.
Bananas.
That's right. Peanut butter and bananas.
Peanut butter and bananas.
Yeah, apparently also the piled bacon on it, but the definition of so-called Elvis sandwich is peanut butter and bananas.
Sweetheart, can we give away the secret now? She's recently deceased.
Who?
You remember Gail Green's book?
Yeah.
She slept with the king.
Yeah.
Oh,
that was
wow.
and right after the whatever they did was over, he ordered the corned beef. He ordered. He didn't say it was a banana sandwich.
He is supposed to have eaten a lot of weird things, you know.
Really?
but help cheer up Elvis.
A lot of
brain.
People like that the peanut butter and banana combination sandwich.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I have it all the time. Yeah.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
But will the plants run out? I mean, aren't we rather worried about this disease that's affecting bananas?
That's right, yeah. I mean, the banana has evolved hugely through human intervention, so that we have created these varieties that are essentially genetically identical. I mean, they don't reproduce themselves sexually anymore, so that you are basically planting clones of the same variety, and at the moment the dominant variety called Cavendish bananas, of the internationally traded bananas, it accounts for 90%, 95%. So unfortunately, there is this disease raging through banana plantations.
Right. right.
Which is killing this variety. And yeah, people are worried that this commercial variety might get soon wiped out. So yes, I mean, it's warning to the danger of monocropping and lack of genetic diversity.
Right.
I mean, it's that crazy because that banana industry had the exact same problem, but in the 1950s with another then dominant variety called Gros Michel, and it basically wiped out. So the Cavendish came to replace it, but then yeah, it's got the same problem. So yeah, now we are actually in danger of losing, you know, that much of the commercial bananas. Yeah.
Right now, we've talked. You mentioned okra already. I don't know that we ever knew the gory details of the fact that okra was used to feed people who had a one-way ticket from Africa to the southern United States.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you
okra, yeah. I mean, you know, enslaved Americans brought a lot of the crops, you know, the from Africa. You know, banana was brought with them, although it originally came from Southeast Asia. You know, the okra, black-eyed peas, you know, the watermelon, and you name it. But yeah, okra is particularly symbolic of the southern food culture. And yeah, through that, the story of okra, I tell the story of how, you know, enslaved Africans play such a huge role in the shaping what is the United States now, not just by providing, you know, the most labor to the slave owners, but also that by becoming the collateral with which slave owners could borrow money. And indirectly, basically shaping the U.S. geographically, because, the U.S. Has its current geographical configuration only because Napoleon decided to sell the middle bit, which then was in French possession and was called Louisiana. So not the current, not just the current state of Louisiana, but the whole bit in the middle. And Napoleon decided to sell that. You know, this is known as the Louisiana Purchase. Yeah. Of 1803, and Napoleon decided to sell that bit because he got fed up with the Americas because the slave revolt in Saint-Domingue, which is now the Haiti today, totally put him off the idea of being in the Americas. So, you know, when James Monroe, then the state secretary, was sent to Paris to negotiate the purchase of what today is the Florida and the port of New Orleans, Napoleon offered the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, apparently when Monroe came back with the whole lot, Jefferson, the then president, flew into a rage saying, "You idiot, I just told you to buy that port and the hinterland. And you bought this useless land," which of course later became the breadbasket of the U.S. and the rest of the world, and then gave the U.S. The stepping stone to become, reach the Pacific Ocean, thereby becoming a continental-sized country. So, you know, I mean, of course, that the Haitian slaves didn't mean to organized that geographical rearrangement, but they ended up actually creating the United States as it is today.
Right.
Now your book is like, I view it as, and you say so, that it's as much about history as about anything else, but do you have some kind of a a purpose for writing the book beyond just historical recording. I mean, are you doing a call for action or suggesting weak spots we ought to prop up, or what is your purpose with this book?
Yeah. No, I mean, as I said in the beginning, I mean, the book is basically a call for ordinary citizens to learn economics, and in learning economics, that it is also very important to learn history, not just narrowly defined economic history, but broader history, because you know can learn so much from history. We don't have to actually, you know, do, if you like, a live experiment with people to know that something works, something doesn't work. And I think, unfortunately, economists ignore history too easily. And every time they come up with something, they think they have invented something completely new, and it was already used elsewhere. And I mean, basically, a lot of the reinventing of the wheel is going on. So, learning history, right, is quite important also in coming up with the practical alternatives for today's problems.
Now, let's not close until we give credit to your native land. Because I got through a lot of pages of your book before I discovered your explanation as to why Korea became Korea and the vibrant economy that it represents. Parked in front of our house, 310 South Highland Avenue, is a Hyundai Sonata. And they're everywhere.
Yeah, they are.
But it was the brave man who bought the first one, I guess.
That's right, yeah. No, I still remember in 1977 when Hyundai produced its first car, well, first of its own model. Before that, they used to assemble Ford models. Right. They exported five cars to Ecuador, and that was the headline in the newspaper. It started from the very inauspicious beginning. I mean, the whole country was like that, you know, that in 1961, its per capita income was $93. In the same year, per capita income of Ghana was 190. So it was one of the poorest economies.
Now, how did that economic miracle happen? It seems to me that there was another factor at work, and geographers didn't get it right, and I'm not sure economists got it right either. I'm talking about the role that individuals, based on what they discover. Uh-huh. People like Henry Ford, for example, made a difference. The people the people who built Hyundai into the marvelous economic engine that it now is were people.
That's right. Yeah. No. Unfortunately, in an attempt to do a kind of a scientific systematic research, economists despite their emphasis on individual initiatives and so on, when actually analyzing the real history, tend to downplay the role of individuals. But in the book, I also try to argue that these visionary individuals are extremely important, but they cannot do it alone. I mean, another reason behind the success of Korea and quite a few other East Asian countries was that they educated their people. They, created the system where the people could work together, in the innovating and developing new ideas. So I mean, everything has to be there together. You know, you need a government with the right policies. You need visionary entrepreneurs. You know, need well-educated workers. You know, the scientists. You know, engineers. So yeah, at one level, there's no secret. There's no magic formula. But on the other hand, getting those things that sound obvious into place is actually not easy. And in order to do that, the government had to put a lot of effort in, controlling how enterprises do their businesses. The government had to provide the right environment.
Let me surprise. I think I'll surprise you. And where it will go from that point, I'm not sure. And I'm going to bore Anne a second because she's heard me tell this story a number of times. But I was in Boston. I was actually speaking at a technical conference.
Mm-hmm.
And lunchtime came around, and I went to the place where you were supposed to have lunch. And a gentleman came over, just a young man in his mid-30s probably, came down and sat next to me. And introduced himself. He said, "My name is Timothy Berners-Lee."
Well, oh, right.
I don't know if you know this or not, but Timothy Berners-Lee essentially invented the Internet.
That's right, yeah.
A totally astounding achievement.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no,
Well, you know, we have lots and lots to talk about, but we're kind of running out of time here. We may have to do a part two on this one. How's June?
Thank you.
Your book is wonderful. Listeners, again, it's Haojun Chang, who is a sterling economist, and not having anything to do with silver, of course. And the book is called Edible Economics. And we actually didn't talk about beef, but you said how beef explains free trade. It's packed with information, and we can only make an effort, a stab at conveying all the information in it. But it's a wonderful book, Haojun, and I thank you for both the book and for talking to us.
Hold on a second.
Thank you very much.
We got so excited we forgot to credit the institution that you work for.
I used to teach in the University of Cambridge. I taught there for 32 years. Six months ago, I moved to University of London in this unit called the School of Oriental and African Studies, which is one of the most interesting places that study.
Interesting.
Yeah, the Global South. So there we go.
Now is Jeremy Bentham still standing in effigy outside the London School of Economics?
Oh, right. No, I don't think that he does. But the rumor has it that he wanted to kind of have his body preserved somewhere. I mean, apparently it's hidden somewhere in the University of London. It's one of these wild rumors that I cannot confirm or deny.
Well, here's another rumor for you. The story goes that when John F. Kennedy became president of the United States, the LSE Daily newspaper headline was LSE guy makes good.
There you go, yeah.
Fun talking to you, Haojun.
Thank you for having
continued
me.
Continued success, and I hope you keep writing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.